Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And the thing I want to talk to you about today is the relationship between Europe's communist parties in the 1930s and the Spanish Civil War. If there was one issue that captivated the left in the 1930s more than any other, it was probably the question of Spain. But that issue in itself was intimately linked to the fears and anxieties that the international left had over the emergence of the Nazi regime in Germany. The left is defined in the 1930s, by left, I mean really the communist and socialist parties, revolutionary parties of Europe, in Western democracies, Great Britain, France, and other democratic countries. Their defining feature in after 1933 is that of agents of anti-fascist struggle. But obviously there's a huge complicating factor in all of this, and that is the position of Stalin and Comintern. By the early 1930s, the Soviets were convinced that Germany was the next country that would fall to communism, that a communist revolution was right there. It had the largest communist party in the world, with the exception of the Soviet Union. It had 6 million votes were cast for the communists in the 1932 November election. And that was the election where, of course, the vote count for the Nazis started to decline, obviously worrying Hitler. And there was a fear that the on the part of Hitler and his fellow travellers, that the moment, the Nazi moment, had passed. And there's a lot of demographic and cephalological evidence that suggests that that may have actually been the case. Essentially a mad scramble to have him appointed as Chancellor by January 1933. And the possibility that as the Nazi moment passed, perhaps Germany was facing a communist one, it was acute anxiety to Germany's bourgeoisie at the time. But ironically, Germany's middle classes needn't have worried. Their knight in shining armour was, curiously, Joseph Stalin. Joseph Stalin argued that the German KPD, the German Communist Party, should look upon the SPD as what he referred to as social fascists. He said that the SPD as moderate non-revolutionary socialists were more dangerous than any fascist movement, because they really are the means by which capitalism perpetuates itself. When capitalism runs into a crisis, it has social democracy to help to kind of ameliorate the rough edges of the crisis and actually prevent revolution and thus perpetuate the capitalist system for time immemorial. And he said, well, they're the much bigger problem, we've got to focus on them. Which was, for Stalin, considering the consequences for the Soviet Union of Nazism, a catastrophic blunder. The Social Democrats in the 1932 election had 7.2 million votes, and the Nazis had 11.7 million, so you can do the mathematics yourself. A Social Democratic and Communist Popular Front alliance would have beaten the Nazis hands down. So Hitler has a lot to thank Stalin for in his appointment as Chancellor in January the 30th, 1933. One of Stalin's best sources of information, not that he listened to him very much, in Germany, was Georgi Dimitrov, who was a Comintern agent. He founded the Bulgarian Communist Party, and he was one of the four German communists, or members of the KPD, who were placed on trial in September 1933 for being involved in the burning down of the Reichstag. Amazingly, they're actually acquitted. And the fact that they're acquitted tells you a lot about how slowly the structures of the formal legal system were compromised or dismantled by the Nazis. It takes quite a while, really, for Germany's pre-existing legal system and the rule of law to be fully undermined. Dimitrov makes it back to Moscow and tells Stalin this class-against-class business, this social fascists accusation, it's really damaging and you've got to stop it. It's part of the reason why Hitler's come to power. Stalin obviously ignores this, and there is a fierce debate against the Seventh World Congress of Comintern, and it's not a debate anyone's got stomach for. There is a sense that tensions within the Soviet Union are becoming irreconcilable following the disastrous collectivization campaign in Ukraine, and Stalin's need really to for an outlet to the criticism of the regime that he encounters the following year in 1934, the Congress of the Victors. But in essence, Dimitrov called for a united front. And this is the beginnings of a united front policies across Europe that are eventually encouraged by the Soviet Union and would be encouraged in Spain, which is where this is all leading. And Stalin is able, perhaps privately, to reflect on the folly of encouraging the communists to attack the Social Democrats, it's all too late. Hitler is in power, and Stalin realizes he has a violently anti-communist leader on his doorstep. In essence, the only country that stands between the two of them is Poland, a country, if anything, Stalin trusts even less than Nazi Germany. In both Britain and France, the liberal democratic socialist parties and the revolutionary anti-democratic socialist parties had been busy making popular fronts of their own. The emergence in Britain of Oswald Mosley and his British Union of Fascists, whom I am delighted to say, 80 years ago today, the working classes and the Jewish emigres of the East End stood up to in the Battle of Cable Street and managed to essentially fight on the streets the fascist movement and outnumbered them about 30 times over. There were 100,000 protesters in the East End who came out to meet 2,500 black shirts marching. So the emergence of fascism in both Britain and France, in France you have the Action Française, galvanises local responses, and the popular fronts develop and hold quite effectively throughout the period. And you have to remember, in Britain as well, after 1931, the beginnings of the national government and the fracture of the Labour Party, the Labour Democratic Parliamentary Left is in disarray, and there's very little chance of any resistance from fascism coming from that avenue. The Labour is engaged in a bitter, fratricidal civil war. So it was the Communist Party that waged the kind of the street war against Oswald Mosley in disrupting his meetings, particularly at the infamous Olympia convention in 1934, when the violence of the black shirts was first really became a kind of a public hue and cry. And if you want to know more about Mosley and the black shirts, I did do a podcast probably a year or two ago now on him, and you can find that in the kind of the podcast archive. So it was a great many British communists who found their way also to Spain. They kind of they cut their teeth on the struggles against fascism domestically, and the fights with the black shirts. And Spain was the next obvious place to go. There was a widespread and probably quite accurate view that parliamentary democracies across Europe were doing nothing to prevent the spread of fascism and were far more interested in containing communism. And therefore, the responsibility to defeat fascism fell to the working class, and it was working class trade union members and anti-fascists who made their way to Spain in large numbers. They weren't exclusively working class. There were a number of middle class and even some upper class British anti-fascists who went, but mainly they were young working class men. And you can read and hear more about this. I did a podcast on the International Brigades, the British Battalion of the International Brigade, again, some time ago, based on the excellent book by Richard Baxall, Unlikely Warriors, which is well worth a read. It seems that one of Stalin's key interests with Spain wasn't so much to win an outright victory. I mean, Richard J. Evans put forward the theory that that Hitler's anxiety was that there would be, to the west of him, a popular front, or socialist France, as it was a popular front governed there in 1936, and a popular front, or socialist Spain, south of that. Thus, his policies towards the east of invasion and eventually the colonisation of the Soviet Union would be stymied by this threat to his flank. So it was worthwhile fomenting a fascist counter-revolution in Spain in order to make sure that any threat from a socialist France would be countered by an allied fascist Spain. This is perhaps the case. Stalin thought that one of the best ways to deal with Hitler would be to draw Hitler into the kind of protracted guerrilla war in Spain that had devoured Napoleon's armies and that had sort of sucked the energy and the lifeblood out of Napoleon. And this could quite possibly have been the way it played out, to give Hitler his own, essentially, Vietnam. But he didn't. For a maddening period of time, luck appears to be on Hitler's side in a number of issues, and Spain is one of them. Spain is an ideal place for testing out.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping
and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The new weapons of Blitzkrieg, fighter and bomber aircraft, tanks, armoured support, and other other various tools of modern warfare. And the Republic and the Republic's defenders from overseas are unfortunately unable to contend with the combined might not only of the general Spanish generals and Nazi Germany, but with huge numbers of troops sent from fascist Italy. We often focus on Hitler's contribution to with the Condor Legion to Spain, but it's dwarfed by the number of troops sent by Italy. For those British people that didn't go to Spain, Spain nonetheless becomes a kind of a romantic and rather totemic issue of the times. Baroness Athol, British member of the House of Lords, launches a magazine called Spotlight on Spain, in which each week the kind of the what she viewed as the seemingly forgotten conflict in Spain was brought to the fore. If you look at the national and regional newspapers in Britain, most of them seem to have stopped short of actually praising Franco, but they focus their reportage on criticising the Republic. I mean, the Republic is seen as this kind of anti-democratic, fifth column, this cipher for Stalinism, which it certainly wasn't. But within the communist movements of Europe, particularly if you look at the Communist Party of Great Britain, divisions that open up within Spain between the various competing factions of the Spanish left really animate discourse. George Orwell, in his Homage to Catalonia, is very sympathetic towards the anarchists of the PUM, the Partido Obrero de Unificación Marxismo, or the Workers' Marxist Unification Party. The PUM were suppressed by the communists, who eventually take control fully of the international brigades, and the fight for the Republic. And this is in large part because the international brigades were essentially organised by Comintern in the first place anyway. They were the forces that Comintern believed it could get away with sending without an open invitation to war, so you know it was easier to send an international brigade to organise international brigades of volunteers than it was to actually send Soviet troops. The British Party, British Communist Party, accused for the rest of its existence, the British Communist Party accused the PUM of being fascists or in the pay of the fascists, which is nonsense. And the or Trotskyite sort of sectarians who, if they hadn't actually been in direct pay of the fascists, they may as well have been, because the result was essentially similar. They had split the communist movement and caused all this sort of suffering and misery. And the thinking later on, again, probably nonsense, was if it hadn't have been for the PUM, well, the Republic might well have stood, and it was all their fault. And this was a way of, when the British and other international brigades returned home, this was a way of retelling the story to themselves of the struggle of the international brigades, and finding justifications for the defeat. In 1938, Franco finally splits the Republic in two, and the British battalion really start to kind of return. By then, it's clear that the war has been lost. But by 1938, actually, Stalin is anxious for the war to continue for a little while longer. He knows that fascism will win, and he wanted the international brigades to stay there. He could see that the issue was no longer Spain. It was the safety of the Soviet Union itself. Stalin needed Hitler to continue being engaged in Spain, and the fascism to continue fighting there, because Stalin could see, in his view, that Hitler's eyes turning eastwards, and he needed time to be armed, particularly as Stalin had murdered a large number of his generals in 1938, and had devastated his army all the way down to sort of junior officer level. There are huge numbers of colonels, brigadiers, divisional commanders, all that sort of thing, all gone. And he also stripped out the air force of most of its talent. It's one of the reasons why in the first few days of Barbarossa all the aircraft are on the ground, because there's nobody commanding air fleets to get them in the air to protect them. But so Stalin knows that he's woefully underprepared for war. And the fact that in that year, Chamberlain, Mussolini, Daladier and Hitler carve up Czechoslovakia, the Munich Agreement, obviously without the telling the Czechs, and more importantly to Stalin, without inviting the Soviet Union to have a say on the subject. In Stalin's eyes, this meant that the Western democracies were already making their deal with Hitler. They were giving him Czechoslovakia, and they would no doubt give him the Soviet Union in due course. And this fits in nicely with Stalin's worldview, the kind of the Marxist-Leninist worldview about what fascism actually is, in the worldview of Stalin. And the fascism is simply liberal capitalism's attack dog. Once there is a threat of communism, liberal capitalism has to kind of create fascism in order to guard itself, in order to sort of set it on the workers' revolution. And therefore it made sense that an attack by fascism would be inevitable, and a deal between fascism and liberal democratic capitalism would also be inevitable. I mean, Stalin was right that an attack on the Soviet Union was largely inevitable, but the thing he never really factored in was that Hitler was looking at things not from that particular standpoint, but from a racial one. That Hitler was wanting to bring a racial war to the Soviet Union. And again, that would cloud Stalin's judgments and lead to all sorts of miscalculations with Hitler later on. One indication of Stalin's change of heart and Stalin's kind of understanding of the threats to the Soviet Union is the abandonment of class against class, and the decision by Comintern to allow local parties in Europe to have greater autonomy. The British Communist Party certainly experienced that in the later 1930s and was not constantly taking rigid directives from Moscow. However, one tradition of the European Communist Parties that did endure, and this was probably non-negotiable, was the anti-Trotskyite standpoint of the Soviet Union that becomes almost a kind of a hysteria with some European Communist Parties. The Spanish Communist Parties viewed the PUM as Trotskyite infiltrators and enemies, and there's this, all this kind of rubbish about trying to conflate Trotskyism with fascism, which is, again, totally ridiculous, but something that was done at the time. I mean, we're constantly bombarded today with political parties trying to paint others as extremists when, you know, really this isn't the case, or trying to suggest that they're extremists in ways that certainly they would never function. So it's not a new thing. And the British Communist Party was fairly obsessed with Trotsky as well. I mean, the irony is, of course, that in the decade before his death in 1940, Trotsky is this marginal figure. He is increasingly impoverished. His entourage, wherever he is, in Turkey, France, Spain, or later Mexico, shrinks around him. He's increasingly overlooked, and he funds himself really through publishing and journalism. He has his network of friends and relations in the Soviet Union are all purged and murdered. He's a more harmless figure to the Soviet Union you'd be struggling to look for, but he seems to cast this terrifically long shadow in Stalin's eyes. But British communists embraced, and really for the rest of the life of the party, wholeheartedly embraced anti-Trotskyism and placed the ills of the Soviet Union at Trotsky's door. And you'd find that Trotskyists within the British left-wing movements, various Trotskyite parties that emerged, had an equally obsessive hatred of Stalinists. And this schism has run through the revolutionary left in Britain for much of the rest of the 20th century. In no small part explains why they're generally viewed as kind of irrelevances by mainstream political discourse. This various kind of obscurantist bickering that seems to have no relevance to anything at all. Anyway, that's as may be. I hope you found this interesting. And really, the point is, I think that when we're thinking about the left in Europe in the 1930s, the issue of Spain is really absolutely at the heart of everything from 1936 onwards that they're really considering. And the reason why is because the fate of Spain, as they see it, hangs the fate of the world, certainly the fate of the future of socialism, because if Spain falls, Hitler triumphs, and after that the left is in great peril. Obviously, from the perspective of socialist parties and communist parties in Europe, they believe that the rise of Hitler was directly about them, and that they were the number one victims, or the number one targets of Nazism. And they kind of weren't wrong in that regard, except obviously the number one target would be Europe's Jews. Anyway, thanks very much, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. Bye-bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.